You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
If the president wants to come up to me and tell me to my face that it was a terrible tragedy and how it should never have happened, and maintain telling us how nothing is going to be done about it, I'm going to happily ask him how much money he received from the National Rifle Association.
Is it possible that the thing which finally shifts America's gun control debate will be angry, articulate high school kids tired of being shot at? My guests Robert Fox and Brian Klass will be discussing that and the day's other top stories, including the reactions to the latest batch of indictments by special counsel Robert Mueller, the possibility of the war of words between Iran and Israel escalating into a war with deadlier weapons, and how do you get busted for doping while curling? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Robert Fox, the London Evening Standard's defence editor, and Brian Klass, fellow in Comparative Politics Department of Government at the London School of Economics. Welcome both. We will start in the United States and the ongoing investigation by former FBI Director Robert Mueller into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. On Friday, Mueller released indictments of 13 individual Russians and three Russian entities, alleging a wide-ranging and sophisticated and apparently successful operation to disrupt American democracy. Among the reactions over the weekend was one from President Donald Trump, who responded with customary equanimity on Twitter, blaming everyone but himself for everything and rage-tweeting an Oprah Winfrey appearance on 60 Minutes, in which he described her as insecure. That's a remarkable, Brian, getting described as insecure by Donald Trump. I think that may supersede the whole pot kettle analogy. But the new indictments, first of all, how significant are they?
They're significant in the fact that they have completely blown up the myth that this was a hoax. There are names, there are dates. Trump claimed it could have been a 400-pound guy on a bed somewhere or somebody in New Jersey. Now we know they were in Moscow. We know they were sophisticated. We know that they planned this for 3 years and that they actually did a huge amount of things. I mean, they organized real-world events. It wasn't just on media. They paid people to dress up like Hillary Clinton in a prison uniform and go to rallies. And so this information warfare operation, in conjunction with the hacking and all of the other nefarious activities, ends the debate over whether Russia was responsible. And that's why it's significant, and that it shows that Mueller is serious about this and he's working methodically to roll up people into actual criminal indictments.
Just to follow that up, Brian, what do you make of the choreography of this, as it were? Robert Mueller going after the... He seems very intent on nailing down the Russia angle. Is he basically, you know, obviously alive to the surrounding politics, trying to make himself unsackable?
So I don't think he's doing this with a political eye. I think he's operating independently. But what I think these indictments show is how absolutely methodically he's working his way up the food chain and also making clear that this is a serious investigation. So you have a lot of the indictments for the previous people like Manafort and Flynn and Papadopoulos, etc., being charged with the most minor crime possible as a way to force a plea agreement so they can cooperate with the investigation. That shows that he's working his way up. That should worry Trump. And then with the Russia investigation, obviously these indictments, these people are not going to be extradited to the United States. They're not going to be put on a show trial or anything like that. But it's sending a very clear signal that we know what happened. And the next question, which is the most important one, is did anyone in Trump world knowingly participate in these activities as outlined in the documents that dropped on Friday?
Well, Robert, on which subject? President Trump is insisting that the indictments contain no proof of collusion between Russia and his own campaign. On the basis of what is being alleged by Robert Mueller, is Trump technically right?
Well, it's not proven. And Scott's law, can we say, that's the point. Where I think to anybody but the faithful and people locked in the inner ring, really, of this fight about Trump would say, why is Trump spending so much time defending himself? and answering charges that haven't yet been placed. I'd like to take up on what Brian's just said, which is extremely interesting. I think there's a bigger picture, if I can do a sort of pull focus on this. This is huge. There is a general recognition among the Western allies. This is the principles that support America, not only through NATO, but through the Five Eyes Intelligence Agreement, that they recognize that Russia and China are so way ahead in quantity and quality in cyber warfare that this will be welcomed, because what Robert Mueller is doing, saying this is damn serious. And this is where the political partisanship in America is only just grasping to the extent of which they can do these operations, to which they're absolutely clear they're going to continue these operations, particularly with the midterm elections, the next presidential, and what the aim is. And the aim is Gerasimov doctrine, disruption. It's not to make war on, but to disruption, to sow discord and disagreement and download faith in the Western systems. This is really what it's about. It's very broad brush stuff, but it does have its effect. In the immediate term, one wonders why Trump is being so sensitive about it, because it doesn't affect his standing with his faithful at all.
Well, he's sensitive they would about expect everything.
That. Yeah,
is the issue there, I think.
And I think that, I don't know, I'd be very interested to know what Brian makes of this. It does seem to be a misstep to attack the FBI, to be concentrating on this and bringing that up over the Florida shooting, saying that, oh, we perhaps wouldn't have had the Florida, which he hinted at in one of his tweets.
Well, he did more than hint at it. He actually said it outright, as if the FBI, which I take to believe, or I believe to be a reasonably substantial organization, is incapable of investigating two things at once.
Yeah, so I think let's start with this bigger picture here. And I think this is where we really have to talk about this. This is a sophisticated information warfare operation. It's going to get worse. There will be more of it. And Trump has done nothing to stop it, nothing to deter it, and effectively has rolled out the digital red carpet to other nefarious actors to do exactly the same thing, but more intensely in 2018. We have an election in a little over 250 days. I think what's really important, though, is if you give Trump the benefit of the doubt, right, you assume that, okay, let's try to find an innocent explanation. Why does he lash out at everyone on the planet other than Vladimir Putin and Russia? Why does he continually blame Hillary Clinton, the FBI, Democrats, lashes out at Oprah, for goodness sakes?
Why won't he sign sanctions which have been passed by Congress?
But he won't sign sanctions against Russia. He won't say a bad word against Vladimir Putin. He won't outright accept the intelligence community's consensus, which has been on the books for years now. And at some point, you sort of have to say, look, this is weird. This is not a normal behavior for somebody. Trump could have very easily put a lot of this political baggage behind him if in January of 2017 he said, Russia attacked us, I'm going to work with the Democrats and the Republicans to shore up our cyber defenses and to ensure that our democracy is protected. And it doesn't matter whose side they were on now or in the past, we are all on the same side now. If he had said that, it would have taken so much ammunition out of everybody's political quivers, and yet he hasn't. And so that raises that perpetual question, why? And it starts to be crystal clear that there's a narrowing innocent explanation here. The only possible explanation is that there's a foreign policy agenda here, and Trump has no foreign policy agenda that he's actually committed to.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move along slightly now. We'll stay in the United States, where it has become customary after mass shootings, or at least those which kill enough people to attract attention, for a tone of resigned fatalism to set in, recognizing that this is just what America is like and that nothing could be done even if anyone really wanted to, which they clearly don't. However, something about the aftermath of last week's shooting at a high school in Florida, which left 17 people dead, feels different. The discussion has been led by the students who survived, and their poise and passion has crowded, perhaps even embarrassed, the gun lobby into relative silence. Here is Florida student Emma Gonzalez.
If the president wants to come up to me and tell me to my face that it was a terrible tragedy and how it should never have happened, and maintain telling us how nothing is going to be done about it, I'm going to happily ask him how much money he received from the National Rifle Association. United States in the 1.5 months in 2018 alone, that comes out to being $5,800. Is that how much these people are worth to you, Trump? If you don't do anything to prevent this from continuing to occur, that number of gunshot victims will go up, and the number that they are worth will go down. And we will be worthless to you. To every politician who is taking donations from the NRA, shame on you.
Emma Gonzalez, a survivor of last week's shooting at a high school in Florida. Robert, a lot of these kids have spoken up. We talked about this on Midori House on Friday. I'm not sure myself what I think about hustling children who've recently survived a dreadful trauma straight in front of cameras, but there is no doubt at all that these kids are remarkably composed and articulate. But that speech in particular by Emma Gonzalez seems to have struck a chord in a way a lot of responses to mass shootings don't. Why do you think that is?
I think because it was so articulate and she did have social media with her and they got onto it, and Trump was very slow off the mark. I think that that's why this has got traction this time. I am not there on the ground. It's very difficult to really feel the mood music and the way it will go, whether it will change anything. I'm quite sceptical because the NRA and its supporters are so strong. They're so resilient against the counter-arguments. But at some point, one does feel, one hopes, that something is going to change. There will be a tipping point. I think that that's what the liberal media, quite rightly, are looking for in there. I'm not sure it's come. I'm just not sure enough of the ground there.
Well, I mean, there is a lot of wishful thinking associated, I think, as there often is to those of us who don't quite see the gun lobby's point and who every time one of these things happens think, surely to goodness, this has to be it. But Brian, I'm just wondering if there is, you know, as Robert mentioned, Trump seemed unusually befuddled by this one, and we'll come on to his response shortly because he's now apparently decided he supports improved gun checks. But I'm just wondering if the reaction is changing because Trump is the president, whether this is another example of Trump having the opposite effect to what he might have wanted. Because if something like this happened on Barack Obama's watch, and something like this, well, several of these things happened on Barack Obama's watch, he turned up, he said all the right things, he behaved with grace and dignity, and, you know, did the whole healer-in-chief thing, made an effort to pass laws, which then failed. And that point, the fatalism set in. But people were able to think, well, at least the president tried. Has it changed because now people are going to think, well, the president isn't going to try?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. But I also think that these are, you know, it's so, so depressingly cynical to talk about it this way. But these are unattackable victims for Trump's Twitter account. I mean, they're people that he can't go after.
Well, he's gone after people you would have thought you can't go after before.
I agree with you. But I think the political costs of this one would be substantial. And it's one of the reasons why he's gone after the FBI and all sorts of other groups who should be unassailable on Twitter, but still are not with this president. I also think, you know, there's a difference in how these people are nearly adults and they're comfortable speaking out with their own voices, which are amplified, as Robert rightly said, with social media and also in front of the cameras. One of the most depressing things is, you know, after Sandy Hook, the mass shooting in Connecticut in 2012, they were children that were 5 and 6 years old. You know, I mean, they couldn't speak for themselves. And these kids can. And I think it's really powerful when a student who says, look, I was hiding under my desk waiting to be killed, and you're going to tell me that you're going to do nothing? That's a powerful message. And the messenger is really important in this case, and in a way that might just break through. Now, that being said, the gun debate in America is insane. I mean, we had in Florida in November, a Florida school started selling bulletproof inserts to put in backpacks. You know, I mean, there was a person at Mar-a-Lago on Saturday night who met with Trump named Wayne Robert Allen, who is proposing armed drones being deployed to schools. I'm not making that up. He literally...
I saw that and genuinely assumed it was a parody
account. It's not. It's a real account. I mean, he actually met the president on Saturday at Trump's club, and he said, look, you know, the drones save lives in Syria. Maybe we could deploy them at schools. It's the craziest thing you've ever heard, but this is the state of the debate. And so there's groups on the right that think, look, the only solution to this is to arm every teacher, which is Newt Gingrich, he's not a fringe player. He's the former Speaker of the House. He said we need armed teachers. And so this is why, you know, you need voices like Emma Gonzalez to break through the insanity to say, look, you know, we're just kids getting shot. And at some point, having our teachers armed is not the solution. You're describing a prison or a war zone and not an American high school.
Robert, returning to Emma Gonzalez's speech and the other kids in particular, and looking at it from the point of view of, you know, how journalists would cover this, can one great speech, one moment of oratory actually shift a narrative?
Well, we really hope so, don't we? I mean, that's the whole, you know, it looks as if, looking at the BAFTAs yesterday, I'm not joking, you get Churchill coming up. And Churchill, as far as I can make out, that film is, I don't mean to disparage the actor, he's obviously terrific, but the film isn't much of a story, but three absolutely stunning, brilliant speeches which defied reality in 1940. Similarly, Martin Luther King, similarly things like not only the Gettysburg Address, but the second inaugural, for example, because we want these things to lift the spirit. I just hope that we will get to a tipping point because we want it so much. But as far as I can see, and I'm looking at a distance, I must say, I cannot see the core ground of Trump support shifting yet.
Well, on which subject, just finally on this, Brian, as I was saying earlier, Trump is now apparently supportive of improved gun checks. Now, is it possible he's serious? Because as far as it's possible to tell, Donald Trump has never cared about gun control one way or the other. Well, he's never really cared about anything one way or the other. But is it possible that this is the kind of simple, verging on sentimental message which appeals to him? Kids are getting shot, I can fix this.
I'm very cynical about this because he said, so what he actually said is that he's open to greater background checks. He's been open to a lot of things that have not come to fruition. And, you know, after the Vegas shooting, which, by the way, was less than 200 days ago when 851 people were wounded, 58 killed in Vegas by one gunman in a matter of minutes, they talked about banning the bump stocks, this device that turns a semi-automatic rifle into a fully automatic machine gun. They talked about it for 4 days. I mean, it's still legal, and actually today it's President's Day in America, and the online dealer that sells these items is running a Make America Great Again discount with Trump's name on it. So, you know, the idea we're going to have this massive sea change for Trump, I think, is a fantasy.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Robert Fox and Brian Klass. Coming up next, an exchange of ambassadors between Israel and Iran comes no closer.
Canada's welcoming attitude is luring entrepreneurs and investors. Monocle Films travels to Montreal to bear witness to the revival of Quebec's largest city and takes note of its success. As government initiatives help drive the change, we hear from Canada's innovation minister about how the country is capitalizing on restrictive U.S. visa policies.
This is a great opportunity for Canada to differentiate itself, to really focus on promoting diversity and using diversity as a means to create more opportunities. And one key area that's really demonstrated that in a meaningful way is immigration. And we think this does really well compared to other jurisdictions in terms of branding Canada, but also really providing the fuel for the innovative economy, which is creative, thoughtful people who want to take risk.
Why startups thrive in Canada. Play now in the film section at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robert Fox and Brian Klass. Now, long-time observers of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be familiar with his predilection for theatrical gestures. Who can forget his appearance before the UN in 2012 with a diagram of an Iranian bomb apparently supplied by the same company from which Wile E. Coyote used to source his Roadrunner trapping equipment. At the Munich Security Conference this weekend, Netanyahu brandished a fragment of what he said was an Iranian drone recently shot down over Israel and warned Tehran not to test his country's resolve. Robert, the drone, first of all, and everything that followed, the downing of an F-16, the retaliatory raids by other F-16s, how big an escalation was that really? Because Israel and Iran have been at war at barely one remove in Syria for years, haven't they?
It's a big change. It's a big change because what they were doing, it's not quite clear because the drone, by the way, is a carbon copy of a US drone that the Iranians managed to get down over Balochistan and they've copied it. It is not clear whether this was an armed mission that it was on. I don't know. I cannot understand. This was Iranian forces inside Syria wanted to launch such a prize bit of kit like this and it was shot down. Then there was retaliation. Ha, this is where it gets very interesting. It's a lucky shot that gets the two F-16s down. One doesn't crash. It gets back to base. The other does crash. So they take out, so they claim initially, half the local Syrian air defences. Then they roll back on that. They're about to do more. I'm speaking from multi-sources in the Israeli press, and Bibi gets a call from Putin, none other, who says, stop messing around with places where my folks are. There's a hint that some Russian soldiers may have been hit in the Tahrir base. But the consensus of comment in the Israeli press, and it's been picked up by some of the American press, is that the Israeli Air Force no longer has free skies over Syria. They've conducted roughly 100 raids over the past year or so, without any comment, without any opposition. Now they're on notice about that. And for me, it was looking as if they were both, that is, the Iranian Hezbollah alliance and Israel, like 2006, were creeping towards a confrontation of a time and a place which they, neither side really wanted. Park that. We've got another thing blowing up now in the south, in Gaza. Israel genuinely is facing a two-front war. And Bibi is doing nothing to damp down the war talk because he is in big trouble. We may be seeing him within weeks exiting the stage if his attorney general decides to go ahead and press, as the police have recommended, the bribery charges, two of which directly affect him. One affects his party and his interests. A cynic would say that this is a colossal gamble, a colossal diversionary move by Bibi Netanyahu at the Munich conference. It's a three-part story. It's the north, where there is an ugly confrontation emerging, and the Russians are fed up with Israel about it, and they've treated each other as frenemies, neither friend nor enemy up to now. You've got a real problem in Gaza. It's a whole story itself, which has been missed out by the British and European press, but it's now beginning to play in America as well as Israel, and we've got the fate of Netanyahu himself.
Brian, Iran's foreign minister Javid Zarif has reacted to Netanyahu waving the aileron around, and it was largely at Mr. Zarif that Netanyahu seemed to direct his remarks. He called it a cartoonish circus, which was probably fair enough, but he did suggest that the F-16 coming down punctured the myth, as he put it, of Israeli invincibility. Are the Israelis likely to see it like that?
No, I mean, I think as Robert pointed out, there's saber rattling on both sides. It's happening. It's political posturing. But I think, you know, there's also this dynamic that's sort of this weird perversion of what's happening in Syria, where the fluid dynamics for a very long time are now starting to solidify, and people are thinking, okay, this is going to be the situation we live with, right? Where all of a sudden the ISIS foothold is getting degraded and, you know, progressively eroded. And there's more of an intensity for thinking about what's the actual fate of this neighborhood, right? This is with Lebanon, with Syria, et cetera. And so I think there's an intensifying urgency to this crisis at the same time that all of these other crises are unfolding and the political crisis is unfolding. And that creates a real volatility that we haven't seen for a while. So it is ramping up. I think it's also worth remembering that in diplomacy and with warfare, miscalculation plays a big role. And this is where I'm really worried. It's in nobody's interest. An Israeli-Iranian war, even a hot proxy war, would be disastrous. But that doesn't mean it couldn't happen. And so that's why I think, cooler heads hopefully will prevail. And also we need some clarity on what's going to happen to Netanyahu sooner rather than later.
Just finally on this one, Robert, Netanyahu said while waving the wing flap around that we will act if necessary, not just against Iran's proxies, but against Iran itself. What sort of circumstances does he think might make that necessary?
I think that's Bibi rhetoric. He's quite good on hot air. He's done it before. I think what is more worrying is, to take up Brian's point, I think absolutely right. I spent most of last week working up a big piece. You're seeing a decline or even a crumbling away of strategy. There is no one power with a controlling plan, a controlling intelligence in the Syrian theater now. And you've got what I've called roughly about nine, looking at the active war map over the weekend, nine quite distinct fragmentary conflicts. And as Brian said, that gives you a tremendous capacity for miscalculation. There are all kinds of players there, but even the Russian strategy, they were seen to be the winners, that they, you know, they were, it was quite clear where they were going. But now they're getting more involved than they want. The Russian nationals are being killed, these weird mercenaries that, that have appeared, the Crusaders of Orthodoxy.
The Wagner Group.
And they're in several places. And now we've got the story, which is very difficult to parse, of Assad saying that he is prepared to put his forces north of Idlib to confront the Turks, to side with the Kurds, for goodness sake, Assad, to side with the Kurds, to stop the Turks taking out an enclave from Afrin to Mabush.
Okay, well, we will doubtless have more opportunity to discuss that. But finally tonight, we should look at the Winter Olympics, which this year, as always, has demonstrated its superiority to the summer version with its array of disciplines which are not merely spectacular, but seem specifically designed to maximise the possibility of maiming their contestants. Curiously, then, the highest profile doping scandal to have thus far emerged has involved the sedate pastime of curling. Alexander Kruzhelnitsky, one of few Russian athletes deemed clean enough to participate, has failed a test for meldonium, whatever meldonium is. Brian, you grew up in the snowbound wastes of Minnesota. Did you ever attempt curling?
I never did. There's a large curling club in St. Paul. I never attended. I have to say, I mean, this
Lake Wobegon.
Yeah, exactly. But I think this is one of those stories that I know that I'll probably get hate mail from the curling community for saying this, but it sort of combines the worst of the Winter Olympics. It's the worst sport in the Winter Olympics and doping. And I think that that's really a shame because the entire point of the Olympics.
It's not dangerous enough, is it, compared to the rest of the Winter Olympics?
Yeah, I mean.
It's Scottish housework.
I think one of the, you know, everybody on Twitter made the same joke, which is, how do you dope in curling, right? I mean, it's just like the least physically demanding sport. Again, my hate mail from the curling community, but it's just compared
the opinions of Brian Klass are not necessarily those of Monocle 24, though I'm kind of
pretty good opinions.
I don't know. There is something hypnotic about curling. I have found myself watching quite large tracts of it without really understanding what I'm doing.
Do you watch lawn bowls as well?
I don't know. No, there's something more lulling about the movement of the curling stone. But I did want to ask you both about your experiences with winter sports, whether you've ever attempted any. Robert, have you ever sort of maimed yourself picturesquely while skiing or anything?
No, but I have a Dutch family, and outside our little farm, you have the longest ice skating race in the world, the Elfstedentocht, talked with the 11 Frisian towns where these amazing farmers would skate 180 kilometres in a day, go back home and milk the cows. They're absolutely terrific. No, it's much too dangerous for me. I can do a bit of sailing and that kind of stuff.
Not much call for that at the Winter Olympics.
But it's, yes, no. Far too rough, this sort of stuff. But, you know, it seems to me that really the one sponsor that there should be for all these strange things where, you know, you can't just do somersault skiing now. You have to go on a rail and so on. Is obviously the Swiss Army knife, you know, but that's the next thing that you've got to do. You use all 32 gadgets to open a tin of Heinz beans and that's the winner.
I'm genuinely in awe of Winter Olympians. I have in my time, in the interests of writing a feature, ridden the Cresta Run, the Skeleton Run at St. Moritz. The first 10 seconds, I think, of the first time I did that, the most frightened I've ever been in my life. And I was dawdling by their standards. Brian, if you weren't curling, what were you doing?
I was a downhill ski racer, so that was my high school sport. It was about 6 days a week throughout the winter, which runs for 4 or 5 months in Minnesota. I grew up on a pond where I would ice skate most days after school. My dad called himself the human Zamboni machine because he would go out with a hose to make it smooth. So I love the Winter Olympics. I think it's a shame that there's curling in them. I wish that there was a lot more of the downhill skiing because the Super G race was the highlight, where a woman who had never been in the top 20, I believe, accidentally won. And it was amazing.
And it does, of course, bring us back to the triumph of Australia's Stephen Bradbury in Salt Lake, I think, 2002, won a short track gold medal when everybody else fell over at the last corner. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Brian Klass has to go and answer lots of emails from angry curlers. Brian and Robert Fox, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Stephanie Sikia. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900, Robert Bound with Culture. I'm back
back with more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.